Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Language, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Malcolm Keating. Today, we'll be talking to Karen Stolzno, author of On the Offensive, Prejudice in Language Past and Present, published in 2020 by Cambridge University Press. Welcome to New Books in Language, Karen.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Thanks for coming on. Let's dive in with what your book's main goal is. It focuses on offensive language, as the title says. What is it that you're trying to do in the book, and why did you think it was important to write?
Well, I think sometimes people might think offensive language is profanity, so swear words, that kind of thing. And but I think there's a new interpretation of offensive right now. One of the most offensive categories of language are insults related to racism and to insults and slurs and terms that abuse people on the basis of some kind of intrinsic factor. So people who belong to various groups, whether it's ageism or sexism or racism or some other kind of ism. So that's the kind of offensive language that I'm talking about. So this has been a topic I've researched for about 20 years. I've been interested in insults and slurs. And so certainly there are two different kinds of offensive language. We can have very overt forms of offensive language, like insults and slurs, but then we can have more covert forms. So that's things like stereotypes and maybe outdated terminology, microaggressions, tropes, assumptions and generalizations, so things like that. So having written about this topic from an academic and scholarly perspective for decades, you know what it's like. It's often not something that's really digestible to the general public with all the terminology that you use within a scholarly area. So I wanted to write something that was going to appeal to the general public and to really look at language over time. So not only the words that we use today, but to look at what these words mean today and what they meant historically as well. So to go into some etymology and to try to explain how words are offensive and why they're offensive as well.
Mm-hmm. So you're really diving into the history of a range of words. So offensive language, sort of a wide basket here.
I look at hundreds of words in the book.
Yeah. And so the hope here is that for people who are not already familiar with this kind of linguistic inquiry, they might get a sense of why things are considered offensive today.
Yeah.
Is that the idea?
Yeah. So it's not about telling people how to speak. It's not about censoring language. Linguistics doesn't do that. It's more describing how people speak rather than prescribing language. So it's when people might hear a term or use a term, and then someone checks them and says, oh, you shouldn't use that term. And they ask, well, why is that offensive? So this book really tries to tackle that question to explain why people from certain groups find certain words offensive. Because if you don't belong to that group, if you're not a stigmatized or marginalized group, it can be difficult to understand why certain terms can be offensive.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you're a linguist by training. Yes. How did you get to be interested in offensive language as a linguist? I mean, there's obviously lots of things you could think about. Why this topic?
Oh, that's a good question, and one I haven't really pondered on too much over the years. I think that my mother, she wouldn't even use euphemisms of profane words like sugar or something like that that some people might use. I've never heard her swear or cuss, whereas my father, he was very different. He would just let out a stream of obscenities all the time, just over the smallest thing. And so I guess opposites attract in that regard. But I think I've just always been interested in this kind of language, and particularly coming from Australia, Australia has a lot of very colourful idioms and terms, and my father in particular would use a lot of terms which are now mostly obsolete, and he was just this great time capsule of offensive Australian language. And so I think being surrounded by it was just something that was curious to me, and then to find out that you could research this topic from an academic perspective I think was fascinating to me. So it's been something that stuck with me, and certainly nowadays too it's been a topic of some importance for political reasons and for social and cultural reasons. So it just seemed like a really good time to write a book on this topic that the average person could read, and that it wasn't just so full of terminology that you couldn't understand it.
Yeah, it's definitely been in the news of late, but for a long time, but especially recently. Yes. We'll talk. There are a few key concepts you use in the book that we'll talk about in a minute. But before we get into that, first of all, you mentioned some colorful Australian language, and then you also mentioned that there's a lot of different kinds of offensive language. How did you choose the particular terms you focus on in the book? You include a lot, but obviously you didn't include everything.
Oh, yeah. And that I didn't want it to be an encyclopedia, obviously, of offensive language. So it was really a matter of looking at, I guess, key terms and a lot of terms which are used very, very popularly in language today. I look at language in Anglophone countries. So that is countries that speak English. So we're talking about America, and we're talking about Canada, Australia, New Zealand. Specifically. And so I looked at categories of offensive language. So as I've already mentioned, sexism and racism and ageism, lookism and religious discrimination in language. So I had all of these different categories, and it was really a matter of, I guess, at first collecting these bad words and figuring out what ones were salient, what ones are commonly used today, and are the ones that people have misunderstandings about too, that people might use very freely and not understand why they can have hidden connotations of offensiveness. Really, I had to scale back, because again, it's an academic book, but it's meant to be a trade book as well. Cambridge have started a new trade series in linguistics, and so I had to please both the peer reviewers and also to make it understandable. So I tried to not make it too listy, because we're dealing with just so many examples, but to provide some examples that really would resonate with people. So if we're talking about sexism, to just look at the language that people use and that people find offensive and that really resonate with people today.
Yeah. So you're talking about, as you say, a wide range of kinds of offense, and we can get into some details here and unpack that a little bit.
Sure.
But one more thing before we do, some of the setup here, you do use a few more academic terms, like, for instance, euphemism, treadmill, and reclamation. So can you explain what those two concepts are? Because they seem to be pretty key in understanding some of the ideas in the book.
Yeah. I mean, people often skip introductions. They can be a little bit drab and boring, but I did want to discuss some key concepts which are highlighted throughout the book. So I mightn't be constantly naming these things, but just to give a brief explanation of what these things mean. So the euphemism treadmill, I think the phrase was initially used by Steven Pinker, the psychologist, and he does a lot of linguistics work as well. And so he used that term to describe a a phenomenon which seems to occur in a lot of areas of offensive language. So, for example, terms related to disability, so ableist language, and terms, racist terms as well. And so it's a concept where a word is brought in to get rid of an offensive term, which is being used. And so it's a euphemism that is somehow meant to be softening and less offensive than its predecessor. But what takes place is why it's a treadmill is that when you replace that word, that new word eventually develops negative connotations too, and then that has to be replaced. And so you have this kind of vicious cycle of words which are brought in to be less offensive, to be more polite, and then they take on the same connotations of the former words. So the example that Steven Pinker will often give is where he talks about words related to the toilet. So previously we would talk about a latrine or a privy or a toilet, and so particularly in America we stopped using those terms and now might refer to a restroom. In Australia, we might still say bathroom. So we're trying to be polite about a topic which incites some degree of embarrassment, and we're trying to lessen the effects of that. But then we have to keep replacing that term because that concept is tarnished.
Right. It gets sullied. What about reclamation? That's in some ways related to this idea of changing the connotations of a word or negating them in some way.
Yeah. So reclamation is very interesting, and it's something that doesn't happen very often. We find in linguistics that words often become sullied more often than they improve in meaning. And we can give some examples of that later as well. But with reclamation, it's if you've got a term which is used against a group of people and is offensive and reveals prejudice, and if that group decide to empower themselves and to take back a word and to start using it and imbue that with positive connotations, that can sometimes be effective. So we've seen that with a term like gay amongst the LGBTQ community. So historically, going back hundreds of years ago, gay meant happy. It could mean all kinds of positive things. And then I think it was maybe around the 1920s that it started being used, I think, both by the community but also against the community. And certainly over the decades, it's developed negative connotations and it's been used as an insult. Even when I was in school back in the 80s and 90s, gay was used as an insult to mean something uncool, in a similar way that lame was used. And so it has been over the past maybe 2-3 decades has been reclaimed by that community and imbued with positive connotations. So it doesn't always work though, but it is it's something that a community can absolutely certainly try to do to change language. But again, language is kind of like a runaway train, and it can be very difficult to impose something on language. But you know, certainly we've seen examples of that historically. It's just a really interesting thing.
Yeah. Well, good. So we'll keep an eye out for those two concepts as we go on. Now, you've organized the book topically, basically focusing on race and ethnicity, then gender, religion, mental health, physical appearance, and concluding with age. So since we're going to take on this topic, let's start with a big one. It's one of the most offensive racial slurs, at least in Anglophone countries. It's typically referred to as the N-word, and that's what I will refer to it here. Now, in the book, you explain the word's history. You also give stories of some famous examples of people who utter it and find themselves in hot water. And I should note that since the book was published, there was yet another case in the United States of Donald McNeil Jr. at the New York Times. And, you know, he allegedly uttered the word in a conversation, not as in a slurring use, but as a mention to clarify a point. And that's maybe a little different than some of the cases you talk about where people are using a slur. Maybe we could talk about that, but it really highlights the extreme power of this word to offend, even just in any kind of utterance. So why do you think the word is so powerful, and how does the history you describe help us with that?
Well, that word has a lot of baggage. I mean, it originally goes back to a Latin term basically meaning black, but it has become associated with so many negative things in history, from enslavement, to forced migration, to segregation, lynching. I mean, just all of the abuses that have taken place against the Black community over the past, I mean, for a very long time, but certainly in the lifespan of this word over the past couple of hundred years, the term has really develops negative connotations. And so this is a good example of that reclamation, in that some people within the Black community have reclaimed the term, and that they use it to mean friend or maybe mate, like the term we use in Australia. So they're using it and reclaiming it and giving it some positive connotations to show, well, I'm close to you, I know you, I'm intimate with you, therefore I can use this term and you know that I mean something good and not something bad. So it really has a very checkered history. And I mean, I'm just trying to think of all the questions that you asked, how to answer all of them.
Well, yeah, I guess the way to start is just the history you describe in the book, and how that impacts the significant power of this particular word.
Well, and I think that's particularly the case in the United States too. I mean, racism absolutely is a thing in Australia and other countries, but it's not really used. I didn't hear it very much growing up in Australia, and I don't hear it very much nowadays here, unless it's amongst the Black community and it's used in a positive sense. So it's really become very taboo. I would say it's the most offensive word in the English language at the moment. And as you mentioned, it has been used by celebrities, including, I think one of the examples I give is Paula Deen. So she hasn't used it recently, but I think she used it going back some time ago. There was a lawsuit against her, and that came up, and she admitted that she'd used that term in a negative way, in a racial sense, and on a number of occasions. And so I think as a result, she lost a lot of contracts that she had with big companies and might have lost her TV show. So, you know, that kind of falls into the whole cancel culture thing that people complain about. Well, some people complain about and say, oh, it's just ruining comedy, it's ruining video games and television. But it's really about accountability. I think America is very forgiving if someone makes a mistake, especially a historical mistake, to come forward and to own it and to say, yes, I did this and that was wrong, and here is why I did it, and I don't do that anymore, so that people can learn from that, so they can become a role model. But another example was with the comedian Michael Richards, who played Kramer, Cosmo Kramer on Seinfeld. And he was at a comedy club and doing a show. And I think a group of people came in, a multiracial group of people, and they were being loud. And so he just started abusing them, and they were heckling him back. And so he used that term, but he didn't only use that term. I mean, it's not just a matter of using a bad word. It's also a matter of revealing negative attitudes towards that group of people. So that word can encapsulate that, but he also said a lot more. I mean, he started talking about lynching and all kinds of things. And I think he thought he was being funny, but he took it way too far. Of course, he did go on to, I think, Letterman and apologized, but it seemed like it was a bit of a disingenuous apology at the time. There have been certainly examples of people using the term. And again, it's these words change over time across cultures, so we really do need to take into consideration context. Here we are talking about this term, and we're censoring it. We're saying the N-word. But, you know, within a book, you have to spell the word out. You're talking about it from more of a clinical perspective. So it really depends. I mean, it's not to say, oh, we can't say these words. We can,
right.
But context really matters.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is one of the points that you make in the book, it seems, is context matters, intention matters, but those are not always enough to cancel out the offense and the sort of taboo-ness of some language. So you mentioned words that sound like the N-word, which people avoid anymore talking about someone who's miserly, just because of the sort of potential for triggering that kind of offense, because it's such a deeply dark word in the English language.
Yeah, we do see that a lot with words that fall out of favor because they simply sound like other words. So not only kind of using a word in a different sense, but also words that are, they might not even be etymologically related, which is interesting when that happens. But yeah, I mean, there was a case that I mentioned in the book, and I can't remember all the details, but I think it was an English professor who used the word homophone, talking about words that have similar phonological relationship, but mean different things. And whoever, someone read it and thought he was talking about homosexuals or something like that, and was offended, and he lost his job for that. So yeah, we certainly see examples of words that pederate over time, just because they somehow resemble that term, either in the spelling or in the way that they're pronounced.
Yeah, that's an interesting feature too that you point out. So let's keep going with some more examples, and I'm going to just continue to speak around them, and
hope our listeners can get them.
But another sort of flashpoint today is gendered language, and you talk about this from a range of angles, and so either in terms of pronouns used to refer to people in the third person, or gendered language like ladies and gentlemen when addressing a group of people. So you also talk about the history of the singular they in the book and the popularity of gender-neutral language. So maybe you can talk to us a little bit about that and explain why you think these changes in language are important. Why is it important that we do change our language?
Yeah, well, I think we've had different waves of feminism, they're called, over the past couple of hundred years. And so in early years, issues like women having the right to vote and having other legal rights, those were at the forefront of issues of concern. And if we go back to maybe the 1960s, the 1970s, around the time that you had, I guess you could call it the second wave of feminism or even third wave of feminism, people began examining, or especially feminists began examining language and realizing that there seems to be a gender bias in the way that we talk. And so, I mean, I do cite a lot of examples in the book, but this can be things like using terms like mankind to talk about both men and women, and phrases like all men are created equal. And you know, often when we have terms too, we might talk about an actor, and that is the unaffected term. That's the kind of main term. And then actress is the affected form. So it seems like women are always somehow secondary to men, and that men somehow constitute the more superior version. And that's an interpretation that you can have. This language has really, sexism is really embedded in the English language in this way. And so we have been changing a lot of these terms since the 1960s and the 1970s, for example, talking about a chairperson instead of a chairman. So you've got lots of guidebooks which are out there too, which address a lot of these issues. And so it's, you know, language is constantly changing. It's constantly evolving. And this has been of concern for decades. So a lot of things that I uncover, then there's nothing new about it. But it is interesting that if we look at a lot of terms for women too, like courtesan, or even a term like tart, that used to come from sweetheart. And so we'll find that mistress as well used to be the equivalent to the word, the honorific master. And a lot of these terms have pederated over time, and they've gone from being a term of status and power and basically being brought down to a place where they're referring to women in a sexual sense, or as being lesser somehow. So it's just interesting that keeps happening to terms related to women. So as for singular they, a lot of people rail against that today. And we see that a lot. People will rail against the introduction of new terms, and they'll really complain about it I'm not going to use this, I'm going to resist this. But language still continues to evolve and do its own thing, despite, you know, people's opinions. But the form singular they has been used by many authors for hundreds of years. That form was used by Chaucer. It's been used by Jane Austen. So the fact that people are now taking that on as a personal pronoun is not really uncommon. But a lot of people who think, well, generic he is the most accurate form. But a lot of these ways of talking really go back to maybe the 19th century, maybe even a bit earlier too, where you had grammar books. And really, there's nothing scientific about these books at all. It's just the preferred way of talking at that time. Some of them were written by clergy, members of the clergy. And so it was really, here's the way to speak if you want to be seen as being articulate and you want to be seen as being educated. So it was really a kind of privileged thing where it was, you know, posh boys in expensive boarding schools who were taught that this is the way that we should speak. So that's more of that kind of prescriptive language that I was talking about earlier, where you're told, oh, you shouldn't end a sentence with a preposition and all of these rules. And, you know, that's really might be a more standard way of speaking, and you in opposition to non-standard dialects and varieties of speaking. But it's not to say that those other ways are wrong or that they're bad or they're corrupt. They're just associated with maybe lower socioeconomic groups, things like that. So it's really a kind of value judgment on the way people speak.
Yeah, and that seems to be one of the themes in your book, is showing that what people take to be sort of a timeless default is in fact grounded in a particular moment of time that's set out by a particular group of people. So folks exactly. who have weird views about Latin teach us we shouldn't split infinitives even, you know, it's not relevant in English. And so that then becomes the sort of standard and invisible for us.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of these kind of conventions were taken from Latin, which doesn't superimpose perfectly onto English at all.
Right.
So really, they're just preferred ways of speaking, and they often do show a form of prejudice.
Yeah, and so you mentioned clergy, so we can talk about religious groups too. That's another group of people. So you were talking about how offensive language can be about groups of people, categories, and things. So you talk about, of course, there's anti-Semitic terms, there's Islamophobic terms. And one of the things you discuss in this section is exonyms and how these can be insults. So what's an exonym? How does it operate as a pejorative?
So that is an exonym can be a word that is used by a group of people to whom that word refers. So, for example, if we're talking about Jew, and that's one of the examples that I give in the book, some people think, oh, Jew is offensive. And I think it's because of the long history of anti-Semitism. People think it might sound a little bit too harsh to their ears, and they should say a Jewish person instead. And we can talk about this later, talking about person first language and identity first language, things like that. But I think I grew up saying Jewish person. To me, it sounded more polite. And so I think there's been a bit of a backlash amongst some people. So not necessarily people who practice Judaism, but also people who identify as being cultural Jews. And they've thought, well, what's wrong with this term Jew? There's nothing wrong with it. It's descriptive. You know, I am a Jew. And so you'll see that thing, I think, in all of these areas, in sexism, in racism, where people will say, well, I'm going to take back this term. There's nothing wrong with it. But yeah, I think in that instance, people have good intentions. And they're trying to be polite, and you might hear the same thing too with you're talking about a Muslim person. But if sometimes if you use a nominal form, a noun, it can come across as offensive if you talk about a group of people as blacks instead of black people, or if you talk about Asians instead of Asian people, or Mexicans instead of Mexican people. It can sometimes invoke the idea of stereotypes about those groups of people.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, let's talk a little bit about the sort of person first language. What do you mean by that phrase, and how does that impact offensiveness here?
So I go into that mainly in the chapter on ableism. So when I'm talking about people with disabilities, so there's an example. So if we talk about person first, we might be talking about a person with schizophrenia or a person with a disability. And so some people have a preference for that form. Other people might prefer to use their identity first, and because they obviously identify with that. So you'll get people who Now, people with autism who prefer to say, you know, I'm autistic, I'm an autistic person. So in that regard, it's really just a matter of, I think it's a changing, constantly changing thing too, where some people may prefer saying, well, I'm a schizophrenic historically, and nowadays might say, oh, I'm a person with schizophrenia. I'm a person first, and this is just a part of me. Whereas an autistic person might think, well, no, this is my identity. I identify as being autistic. That's more important than necessarily referring to me as a person to say that I'm autistic. So that really just comes up very heavily in that particular topic. And it's just really a matter of personal preference. And I think you just have to talk with people and communicate with them and see what terms they prefer, because this is just really a changing thing, and people have their arguments for why they think that some terms are more polite than others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it sounds like there's certain terms where the euphemism treadmill maybe has taken over. So, for instance, person first language, when we talk about race, mm-hmm. no one says colored people anymore. People say person of color, mm-hmm. Even though you might think, well, isn't this the same? But there's a general consensus that no, it's dehumanizing the other way. But then within the disabled communities, there's divergences among them, and so some context sensitivity is necessary. Is that kind of the idea? Yeah. Taking stock of the context?
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. And if I can just go back to what you said about person of color, mm-hmm. I did an interview last week with a wonderful woman, Jamila Bay, and she talks about sex and politics and racism, and she's used to work for NPR and does a lot of radio shows. And so she expressed to me her dislike of the term woman of color or person of color. And so I do mention that in the book, that again, I really can't account for everyone's preferences. It's a matter of communication. But to me, my theory is that it's close to the term colored people, which is really heavily associated with segregation and the days where you had, oh, here's a water bubbler for white people, and here's one for the colored people. And so they were always in this kind of binary. You had white people and then the other. And as Jamila was saying too, person of color can refer to so many different ethnicities and so many different nationalities and identities, that she feels what resonates best with her is the term black, that description is better for her, that she wants to be called the black woman. That's how she identifies. Which makes total sense. But I think that certainly, again, it's a case of people doing their best to be polite and using a term that they think is polite and not hurtful. But in some instances, you'll have someone who'll challenge that and correct you. And again, it's just a matter of listening and using what term they prefer. It's pretty easy. People say, mm-hmm. you can't say anything more.
Right.
Absolutely, you can. These things are changing and always have been. Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of keeping up.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the point you were making there too, with the person of color versus a black person, is that it seems like, well, the context matters. Who are you referring to? Are you trying mm-hmm. to refer to a group of people, as you're saying, sort of in opposition to a default white group? Are you trying to refer to specifically black women, in which case, women of color isn't going to be quite accurate. So
it's too non-specific, and you get the same thing too with some people with a heritage from Asia who might say, oh, well, don't refer to me as an Asian person. I'm a Chinese person. And then you might get some cases too where people aren't very familiar with Asian countries, and they might just refer to any person that seems Asian to them as Chinese, and therefore they're not taking into consideration that that difference. I think even when it comes to the term like black, there are some people who say, well, that doesn't describe me. I'm brown. And so in the interview that I did the other day, we did discuss color categorization and how that's not terribly scientific. I mean, there's no biological basis for race, and the terms that we use. I mean, my son is 5 years old, and he often says, "What color are you?" And I That's a difficult question to answer. I mean, some people would refer to me as white. My skin's kind of pink. So it is a really difficult question to answer. And these categorizations were created by Linnaeus and other scientists talking about people who were yellow. And that often has very negative connotations today, or talking about people who are red. And that has negative connotations too. So it's quite fascinating that we have negative connotations with yellow people and red people and black people, but astonishingly not white people. You know, white people, that they're seen as somehow being the default and everyone else is colored. So yeah. You can understand how this must grate against the nerves of most of the rest of the world.
Yeah, and so grappling here with trying to carve out boundaries with language, which is never going to be precise or free of connotations.
That's right. And I did have this discussion maybe about 15 years ago with a lecturer at university, and I was talking about a term and saying, oh, this term's neutral. And she said, no, really, all language is loaded, and all language can have positive or negative connotations when you really think about it. And certainly that's a case with stereotypes. You wanted to delve into that a little bit. And you can have positive stereotypes, something like, oh, Asian people are really good at math, or as we'd say in Australia, maths. And that's such a generalization and an assumption, and it's so fixed, it doesn't allow for the possibility that not all people are that way. And stereotypes is absolutely something I go into in the book.
Yeah. And as you say, also Asian, well, I mean, living myself and working in Singapore and coming to understand Asia is a big place with lots of fine-grained distinctions that Asian doesn't capture, as you're saying.
Oh, yeah. Certainly I only touch upon those issues in this book. But when you look at prejudice and discrimination in countries in Asia, that's something entirely different.
Yeah, you would need a whole different book for a different group of people, Anglophone speakers in other countries.
Absolutely.
That are, you know, etc.
Yeah.
So it's complicated.
And again, this is a snapshot, as I say. We can look at language diachronically, which is over time, which is what I do to some point, and synchronically as well, which is kind of taking a snapshot. So this book, you know, if I do say so myself, it is going to be redundant in, 10, 15 years. Hopefully I can do a revised version. But these things are changing all the time, and it's not too difficult to keep up with it all.
Yeah, well, and it'll be a snapshot of a particular period in time, which is an important resource to have as well.
Yeah,
see what things look like.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, let's say just a little bit more about the religious groups in that chapter. Is there a particular word or history that you think would be helpful for our listeners to get a sense of those kinds of terms?
Gee, I think I focus on anti-Semitism, and I focus on Islamophobia. And excuse me, I'm a bit croaky. There are some complaints that people have with the term Islamophobia, because if you look at terms that have that suffix phobia, that's implying some kind of psychological condition. It's like talking about claustrophobia, that you have a fear of small spaces. And perhaps to some extent, you do have an irrational fear in some communities of Muslim people. But I do think that most Muslim people would prefer to talk about anti-Muslim prejudice or anti-Islam prejudice. And you will have a lot of people too who say, oh, who are Islamophobic or who are anti-Muslim, who will say, look, I'm talking about the religion. I'm not talking about the people. But it's really hard to separate the religion from the people when you're talking about the religion. Typically, you're talking about the people, you're talking about the culture, you're talking about the history. You can't really separate those things. I think those are really the focuses. And I think Islamophobia and anti-Muslim prejudice, they have been of great concern in America and Australia too, and other countries just over the past maybe 4-5 years. And we've really seen a resurgence of that. And it's so interesting because we just go through these periods of having an enemy. So we call it othering, us and them. So if we talk about us, when we position groups in that way, typically we're saying, oh, we're superior, we're better, we're more cultured, we're more modern. And then this other group, so for example, Muslim people, they are backward and they are savage and barbarians and they are against modernity and you're positioning them in this negative light. And so in terms of stereotypes too, you're saying this about an entire group of people. You're not allowing for any kind of differentiation across people for the fact that you're writing off millions of people just with your stereotypes. And stereotypes may occasionally have a grain of truth, but usually it's just an assumption that doesn't have any basis in actuality.
Yeah. And so characterizing Muslim people by things like a particular kind of clothing or...
Yes. So identifying differences maybe in the foods that they eat or the foods they don't eat, the way that they dress, being different to us. And there was Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister in England, Britain. He had referred to maybe 10 years ago, he'd referred to women wearing veils as looking like letterboxes. And I mean, he said a lot of things over the years about that group of people. I think we can be so tribal in our beliefs that just the smallest thing that can be seen as a difference will be enough to set us apart and for us to hate that other group and to be fearful of them. And it really has goes back thousands of years, I think, this kind of prejudice and discrimination, yeah. Fear of the people of the other.
Yeah. Yeah, and as you're saying, the sort of dehumanizing by using food or clothing as a sort of metonymical shorthand for a whole group of people, often without awareness of, for instance, the difference between a burqa and a niqab and the different kinds of clothing, that sort of totalizing, I think, it's important for the Islamic context that you're talking about, but also just it seems like a general theme, again, throughout a lot of the kinds of offensiveness in these words.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of people see that kind of headgear as being oppressive. But for women, and there are certainly some Muslim women who think, oh, it's oppressive and I'm not going to dress that way, especially if they're living in an Anglophone country. But there are certainly many other women, and it's not a sign of oppression to them. It's a sign of their heritage and their identity, and it just means so much more. And yet you've had these cases of women who've had their veils stripped off them. And I mean, even cases of Amish people where people have cut off their beards and, they've been growing their beards, men who've been growing their beards their entire lives. It's just such a violation, such a physical attack against a person. And people get really violent about people having different beliefs.
Well, let's shift gears to talk about another kind of categorization and differentiation, and that's the chapter on words about mental health. And one of the big ones, I think, is the word crazy, that people use to refer to things that are unusual or strange. But you trace the origin of this word back to the 17th century. And talk about how that word has some connotations that are not great.
Yeah. So, I mean, we need to look at context and the usage, not only meaning, but you absolutely get people who use the word crazy in a positive sense, that something that's crazy good, I'm crazy in love, all those kinds of phrases. And the term is so widely used. And historically, we have this association of crazy with mental illness and the association with terms like lunatic. And so all of these terms that have been used in a very derisive way to talk about people with mental illness. And so it has been becoming offensive for quite some time. I couldn't tell you exactly how long, but I know friends who've completely stopped using the term. And I find it difficult because it's just really easy to dismiss someone who has different views to us and to say, oh, they're crazy. it's really, really easy to do that. Of course, we've got millions of words in the English language and we can choose alternatives. But it is one of those difficult ones that's certainly going to be around for some time, but it's becoming more and more offensive because of its connotations. We see the same thing too with a word like stupid. I know people who won't use the term. And then other people will say, well, look, if I'm criticizing an idea and I'm saying that's a stupid idea, I'm not criticizing a person as being stupid. But in a sense, you are. If you're talking about an idea or a policy or a thing as being stupid, usually there's a person that's behind that too. So again, it's not my position to say don't use these words. It's just a matter of explaining what they have meant and what they mean today and how people interpret them today. And then you make that decision. But it's very likely that these terms, although sticking around, will become more and more offensive over mm-hmm. the years.
So you're essentially giving readers a chance to understand why someone might say, hey, I know you don't intend to call anyone crazy, but when mm-hmm. you say, hey, that's really crazy, here's why I hear this in an offensive way. And then the reader can sort of decide whether they want to refrain from it entirely, be more mm-hmm. judicious, or et cetera.
Yeah, it's a book of tools. It's information. Mm-hmm. You can take it or you can leave it. But I think you'd be hard pressed to read the book and to not reflect more closely on the way that you speak and the attitudes and the values and beliefs that emerge from the way you speak, and to really start nutting that open and reconsidering the things that you say.
Yeah, yeah. So another term in the book that you use is lookism, and mm-hmm. it overlaps with concerns about ableism and disability and also gender and other categories. One of the interesting discussions that I found in that chapter was talking about hair color. And I know this is for the folks in the U.S., talking about someone being ginger isn't necessarily that strange or doesn't trigger that much. But for people in the UK and other contexts, it can be. And maybe in the US context, blonde is the more dangerous sort of category. What's the deal with this focus on hair? What's going on here?
Excuse me, another cough. So I would like to just go back to the first point that you made and to say there is a lot of overlap, I think, throughout the book. If you're looking at religious discrimination, you're going to often find that there's racism underpinning that too. If you look at sexism, you'll often find that there's racism and sexism are intertwined. And so certainly with lookism. Now, lookism isn't as popular of a term as ageism or racism, but it is one way to describe discrimination against people on the way that they look. And that can be because it's a person with a disability. It can be because of the clothing choices that they have, that a goth person wears all black, or it can be because of your hair color. And that was a kind of a fun and interesting topic. And it's, again, one of these things is going to change across culture and time. If you look at red hair, now I'm somewhat of a redhead. My son has more of a kind of strawberry blonde hair. And quite recently I met one of his teachers at school who, for the first time, and she said, oh, now I see where your son gets his gorgeous red hair from. And so it seems to be a positive thing in America. And in Australia, I think people can kind of take it or leave it. Now, my father had some offensive older Australian phrases that he would use about people with red hair. And you have stereotypes about people with red hair, the red-headed stepchild, that they're associated with, I think, because of the color, associated with fire and associated with things like anger and being tempestuous and all these kinds of traits. And people will even make judgment calls about their skin and their freckles and that they burn easily. And so it's just quite astounding how much over time redheads have been discriminated against. And, you know, on the surface, it mightn't seem like it's very much, but I think I can't remember the term, but there was a term that was used in France until quite recently. And it, I think, basically referred to people with red hair as Judas. And so I think there was this belief, if we go back into Christianity, that Judas was redheaded. And so therefore, you know, that's a kind of slight against him. And so I do go into a lot of examples in the book. I mean, you have positive stereotypes of people with red hair as well, like was it Pippi Longstocking and Anne of Green Gables? I mean, I grew up loving those Canadian books. And so you've got positive stereotypes where men will think, oh, women with red hair are just gorgeous and sexy, and even an idea that all redheads are Irish, and that's not true. I think there's a greater population of redheaded people in Scotland than there is in Ireland. But they're so rare. It's something like, I think, less than 2% of the population. But in England, as you mentioned, it's really rampant. I mean, people in America would be astonished at the kinds of prejudice that redheads receive. And so they are called gingers. And so, again, that kind of goes back to that blacks or Mexicans. It's kind of dismissing a group with this noun and a lot of stereotypes encapsulated with that term. And, I mean, I go into some examples in the book of redheaded people who have been hounded out of their homes, hounded out of their communities. There was some comedy show, I think it was the Catcher and Tate show that I watched years ago, and there was a skit about a woman who had red hair and was sent to some kind of home because of her red hair. And so there's this collective of redheaded women living there in fear of the rest of society. And I think unfortunately there's some truth to that, particularly in Britain. And you have a long history in Britain of discrimination against Irish people and Scottish people, and a lot of assumptions and stereotypes associated with them. So I think it really goes back to that. But it's just, again, if we can't discriminate on people on the basis of their skin color, then we'll look to hair color instead. We're terrible. It's always something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess for the sake of time, we'll move on. But just to note that in the U.S. context and in other places, you talk also about blondes, and of course that intersects with gendered assumptions, in particular about blonde women.
Yes, so I guess that the stereotype of women in particular who are blonde, that they're dumb, the dumb blonde, the blonde bimbo, and we might have some stereotypes about that associated with some men, but usually it's women. So again, you've got that overlapping.
Yeah. So let's talk quickly about the last bit in the book, which is about ageism. And this is something that I don't know. It seems relatively recent to me that there's a lot of discussion about generations, for instance, online, especially like millennials versus Gen Z or versus boomers.
Yeah.
The Gen Xers like me, nobody talks about us. We're totally left out.
Yes.
But it seems like there are ways to either implicitly or explicitly categorize and insult or stereotype people negatively by age. So what are some examples of that, and why is it harmful, do you think?
Well, ageism, I finished with that because I think it's something that if we're lucky enough, we're all going to encounter. And that is really one of the premises of the book too, that do we want to be prejudiced against people knowing that we're all going to be prejudiced against for some reason at some point. So yeah, ageism is really something that cuts across all of those other categories. But it's something that's so interesting because we really internalize ageism. And as we're growing up, we hear all of those phrases about being over the hill and just other idioms and terms. And it just seems like it's really one of those last acceptable forms of discrimination. And I mean, my father unfortunately passed away late last year, and he was in a nursing home. And I mean, we can talk about that too. Some people find the term nursing home to be offensive. We should talk about aged care because there's a lot of infantilization when it comes to talking about older people. But he would talk about not liking being there. So my brother put him there. I didn't have any say in it, but he would talk about the old people there and how he hated being around these old people. Even at his age, in his 80s, he was separating himself from these other people. But ageism really does affect all groups. It not only affects older people, and that's the traditional, more salient version of ageism, but it certainly affects middle-aged people. And you have ideas of midlife crises, and that's another kind of sexist thing against men. But absolutely, you have ageism against children. And so some people would refute this and say, oh, it doesn't exist, but there are terms for it. There's adultism or childism. And, historically, we've been very mean to kids. They should be seen and not heard. And we talk about the terrible twos. And, we really do stifle kids in many ways and refer to them as little brats and monsters, that kind of thing. And then, of course, there's discrimination against teenagers too. And we talk about them as just being useless and lazy and just all of the stereotypes associated with being a teenager. And we know how difficult it is. I mean, every stage of life is difficult for one reason or another. And so we should try to have compassion across age. We really do just accept a lot of these terms and the hurtful birthday cards. I went to a birthday a couple of years ago of a friend and his wife, now wife, she said, don't mention his age, don't talk about it. And so we didn't. And he was turning 50 at the time. And we certainly, I think it's particularly difficult for women. There is that kind of double standard where as men age, they become more, debonair and they age gracefully, that kind of thing. And whereas, and with women, there's a lot of pressure on women to stay young and to do all kinds of things, to, anti-aging preparations and things like that. And then at the same time, if they try to take care of themselves, oh, they're vain, oh, they're superficial. It's very difficult for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and the ageism thing too, with the older, senior, older, I'm not sure again which term is best here, but there was another interview I did with some cognitive linguists thinking about aging and language and talking about how these stereotypes negatively impact people's linguistic and memory capacities as they grow older because they internalize them. So yes, it seems like there's just studies.
There have been some studies to show that. But certainly if we talk about age in other ways, age about objects and things, we talk about aged things and vintage things, and there are positive connotations of antiquity and value. So if we talk about vintage cars, if we talk about aged cheese, these things are seen as being of value. But when we talk about older people, we really write them off when they hit a certain age. And and further to what we were saying earlier, that a lot of terminology we use when we're talking about older people can really be infantilizing. We talk to older people like they can't hear us, and we talk to them all like they're not even there, like they're not even in the room. And we can talk about even the things that they use as referring to them as though they're in childhood still, and that is completely negating their life's experiences and all of their accomplishments and the people that they've become, and just acting as though, oh, they've returned to some kind of childish state, which is unfair.
Yeah. Yeah. And even the idea that a childish state is not fully a person too, like you were saying, kind of connects up with the idea that we don't treat children in some ways very, very well. That just because children don't have full intellectual capacities yet as they're growing doesn't mean they're subhuman or less than a person.
It's like we're dismissing the very young and the older people too, and even with terms that we use like the old or the elderly. Anytime we talk about groups, people in terms of groups like that, we're just looking at them for one aspect of their identity, and we're dismissing all of their other accomplishments and everything else about those people. So,
yeah. Well, I think that your book then, throughout the conversation, we just see over and over again these various ways in which our language enables us to categorize, which is a good thing about language, but it brings in all of these potentials for dehumanization and negative connotations. And if it's not possible to stop the euphemism treadmill, at least we can be more aware while we're on it, how we can become compassionate in our language use to others, or just be aware of what we're doing and reflect on it.
Exactly. And again, as I've said several times throughout the interview, just to speak with people and ask, what are the preferred terms? What term do you prefer to use? And people are always happy to say, well, I refer to myself this way, and to use those terms and to listen to other people, because to put ourselves in their shoes.
Yeah, great. Well, let me close just by asking, now that this book is out, what else are you working on right now?
I'm working on several different projects. Nothing that I have a contract for at this point, but just a number of different things. I guess one that I'm trying to finish up now is a chapter for a book about pop psychology. And I've written in the past about this strange concept called spectrophilia, which is the belief that humans can have relationships with other beings like aliens or maybe demons and ghosts. So yeah, it's a strange topic, but I've written about it in the past, and so I was tasked with writing this chapter. But there's a lot more history to it, and a lot more, it's more academic than you would think.
Right. Like different cultural contexts, is that the idea where this appears?
Yeah, so you're looking at this throughout folklore and mythology and also popular culture, and then you've got some more modern day claims too, where a lot of celebrities have said they've had relationships with ghosts, and so you've got that kind of more personal account angle too. But it's a strange topic.
Interesting. And this is apart from the famous movie, of course, right, with Whoopi Goldberg. And
why do you mention that? Yeah, I can't write about that topic without mentioning that, and the ghost and Mrs. Muir, and there's a lot of kind of fantasy and romance. Yeah. And fiction and true stories, apparently, to movies like The Entity. So
interesting. Well, be on the lookout for that. In the meantime, thank you so much for all your time taking us through the book today. It really does. It's a sort of a whirlwind tour through a lot of different words and a lot of different history. So thank you for
that. Well, thank you for having me on the show, Malcolm. Really enjoyed it.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.